The scripture reading for this morning will be Job chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited him against me against him, to destroy him without reason."
Good morning. We're going to begin this morning a four-week series in the book of Job. If you know anything about the book of Job, you know that it's long enough. I will not be covering all of it in a four-week series. We're going to hit a few of the critical points in the book to give you an overview of what's going on in Job and hopefully get to expose you to some of the questions of the book of Job, of what it's supposed to make us think about, what it's supposed to make us ask about. It turns out that there are some riddles in the book of Job. The book of Job itself, the story of Job, is very short. The entire story of Job takes place in three brief chapters, chapter 1, chapter 2, and the very last chapter. Read those three chapters and you've read the entire story of Job. There's 42 chapters, which means that there's 30 some odd chapters in the middle where people are arguing about the other three chapters, in particular the first two, where five people are arguing about the significance of these events that have happened in the life of Job. In that sense, it's a very rare book. Usually when we read a book of the Bible, we read the events, and then we go to Bible class and we argue about what it means. The book of Job, you get to go and read somebody else having the Bible class, somebody else arguing, what does this mean? Only they aren't people who are looking at it from a distance. They're people with, like Job, quite literally have skin in the game. I mean, literally scraping the skin from his own body in agony and asking the questions that he asks about suffering. So it's an enormously significant book to us, because what are we doing as religious people? Well, we're living through life and we're trying to figure out, what is the significance of these things that happen in my life? What does it mean when this happens to me? And I think the book of Job forces us to begin to encounter those questions. I'll go ahead and say this week we're going to start with chapter 1 and 2. It's a long book, which means I'm not going to be able to answer questions this week that we have about Job. In fact, really the significance of chapters 1 and 2 is just about asking the questions. We might, by the time we're done today, be able to answer two questions about Job out of 40 that we have. But we want to start out today by asking the question. So I say that to prepare you, so that when you leave here, you don't think, well, Ben didn't answer any of my questions. No, that was on purpose, because we're going to come back next week and talk about it some more. But for now, we just want to look at the story of chapters 1 and 2 of Job and talk about the misery of a righteous man. First of all, we want to introduce our righteous man, the book of Job, named after a fella named Job. Okay, pretty straightforward in that sense. And what do we know about Job? He's a good fellow. Job chapter 1, verse 1, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." Interesting side note, this story found in the Old Testament is not about a Jewish man, apparently. The man Job comes from a land of Uz. He might be something like a contemporary of Abraham, out wandering the world, some part of the world, who's to say. But it doesn't introduce him as he was of the tribe of this or that, or he was a descendant, he lived in Canaan or something. Nothing like that. This man is not even a person who is part of the rest of the story. So when you read the book of Ruth, for example, at the end of the book of Ruth, it ties it in and says, this is how it connects to the story of David. Well, Job, you don't get that. Job is just a self-contained story to itself. Some man named Job out there in the world in Uz, and you can get out your map and find Uz if you want. Good luck with that. He's just out there, right? And that's who he is. You don't even need to know where he's from. If it had said he was Job from Disneyland, the story would read just the same way. None of that's actually significant. It's the character of the man that makes it significant. What kind of man is it? Well, this is a man who fears God. The book of Job in your Old Testament, if you're looking to find it, is found in the wisdom section of the Old Testament. So it's right there next to the Psalms, next to the Proverbs, next to Ecclesiastes, next to Song of Solomon. It's in the wisdom literature section. And the wisdom literature teaches us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So how does it introduce Job to us? This isn't a foolish man. This isn't a man who is unlearned. This isn't a story about some simpleton who needs to figure out how to get his life together. This is a man, from the moment we introduce ourselves to him, who fears God and reverences and respects his God. This is a man who turns away from evil. A lot of Bible stories don't start that way. A lot of times we get introduced to a wise man, like maybe Solomon, who turns towards evil, right? And the point of the story is, don't be like that. Don't get caught up in sin. No matter how smart you are, you can get into trouble. That's maybe the story of Solomon. But that's not the story of Job. Job is a wise man. Job fears God. Job turns away from evil. He's making good choices, by and large, throughout at least these first two chapters. Job is priestly and selfless. For that, skip a bit down to verse 5, which I think is one of the more interesting verses in this little section. And when the days, this is speaking of his children, had been out feasting. Job's children were out feasting, and when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. What kind of person is Job? Think about this a minute. He's offering sacrifices for himself? No. Well, he's doing that too. But he's offering sacrifices for his children. Because they sinned? No. Because he heard them that they might have sinned? No. He says, in case, just in case, they did something wrong in their heart, I'll go ahead and offer a sacrifice for them. This is the ultimate priestly figure, right? He is attending to the spiritual need of his family to the extent of, think about this. How often do you or someone you know say these words, "Oh, I'm praying for you"? Among Christians, that word is almost like, "Hey, how you doing? Hey, yeah, I'm praying for you." And a lot of times we say it and we actually don't ever utter those prayers. Job, he's not just praying for you. He's literally taking an animal out and sacrificing that animal on behalf of his children out of concern for their well-being. Just in case that day they had cursed God in their hearts. That's the manner of man. He's selfless, he's attentive, he's spiritually minded, and above all, this is a person who trusts God. He expects that God is the creator and master of the universe, that his God is in control, and so with his concerns for his children, he takes those to his God. So again, fears God, turns away from evil, priestly and selfless, trusts God. Model citizen. This is the kind of person at this point we'd all like to be. From there, the scene takes a dramatic and strange and unparalleled twist. In verses 6 through 12, you get a scene that simply happens nowhere else in the Bible. It is, you know, at the end of the DVD where they show you the behind the scenes, how they made the movie and how they did the CGI and how they did the props at the end of the... This is a cutaway to the part of the story we never get to see any other time. In ancient literature, this is what most of the book is about. In ancient literature, they said, well, the gods up into heaven, go do this or that. And they'd argue about that. But it's rare in the Bible. The Bible, when you think about it, is mostly about people. In the story of the Bible is about God, but very little part of the Bible actually happens in heaven. The story is about people on earth who are spoken to by their God, except for this one rare scene and its parallel in chapter 2, where this very strange event unfolds. You're going to have questions about it. I'm not going to have answers. It's just laid out there as, well, of course it happened. This is the way it goes. And so here's the way it reads, beginning in verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came up among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?"
Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Everybody understand that? Great, moving on. No, it's a strange scene, right? We're not exactly sure what's going on. We are up in the presence of God. The sons of God could either be a description, maybe metaphorically, of righteous people were worshiping God and Satan comes among them. That's scary. Or it could be, as speaking of an angelic host, which would make sense. Quite often in the Old Testament, sons of God describe angelic beings. And so there are angelic beings doing what angelic beings do, and they're worshiping God, and up comes Satan. I don't know if he got an invitation or not, but there he is, and he shows up. Who is in charge of this scene? God is. From moment one, God asks all the questions. He says to Satan, where have you been? What have you been up to? And sure, Satan gives kind of a catty, irrespectful, irreverent answer. Oh, you know, here, there, and everywhere. Walking around, doing stuff. Which is, you know, it reminds me of a scene, you know, when the teenager gets asked a question by their parents. And, where have you been? Oh, you know, doing stuff, doing things. It's a really, it's an intentionally disrespectful answer. But it's clear, though, who's in charge of the conversation. God says, where have you been? And it's God that calls attention to Job. One thing I learned in this book is that I don't want God to call attention to me. Because at that point, everything's bad for Job. If God ever says, have you noticed my servant Ben? Then bad things happen from then on, right? But Job's the kind of guy that God can look at him and say, have you considered my servant Job? Apparently, and again, I can't explain this because the Bible has nothing else to say about it, just Ben's 2 cents and maybe half a cent. Apparently, Satan and God have some kind of running argument, which kind of makes sense, that somewhere behind the story of human history and creation and all that, there is some kind of running argument between God and Satan. And it seems to be about whether or not anyone can actually make God happy. Satan seems to think, Ben's half cent is all it's worth, that God is such a being, his standards are such standards, that no one can ever actually live up to those standards, angel or anything else. That ultimately, everyone fails to please God. God points to Job and says, have you noticed? This person, made a little lower than the angels, no less, seems to be doing all right. Have you noticed him? To which Satan responds, well, of course he is. You paid him off. Satan, to translate kind of his question, it is an accusation. He is saying, no one is actually good enough for God, and the only reason Job is doing what you want is because you paid him off. He's not doing it because he's good. He's not doing it because he's righteous. He's doing it because when he does it, you give him stuff. He's rich, he's blessed, he has family, you paid him off. And when somebody does what you want because of a bribe, you can't call that righteousness. So Satan says, I'm not impressed. Take it all away, and Job will curse you like every other being that's ever known you. That's what Satan is trying to claim. That there is no way to have a relationship with God based on goodness, because nobody can be satisfactory to God. And so God does something kind of remarkable. I don't know how else to describe it. God trusts Job. Usually in this story, we emphasize that Job trusts God, and that's true. But God looks at this person, Job, and says, he's going to do okay. Take it all away, and he will show you actual goodness. Which brings us to the first
insurmountable question of the early portion of the book that we're not going to answer this week. We just have to notice it. And we're going to spend the rest of the book of Job trying to understand it. Why do this? We don't doubt that God has the right. Listen, you don't own anything. Not a single thing in your possession belongs to you. Everything you own is a gift from God. And if he wants to snap his fingers and take all of it away, he is well within his right to do it. But that doesn't seem like the normal way God behaves. The question isn't whether God is in his right to do it. The question really becomes, can I like a God who does that? Can I admire a God who allows this sort of thing to go on? And we even kind of get around it a little bit. You see what I did there? I say, well, God allows it. It's really Satan's fault. God permits it. But the text isn't even that evasive. Keep reading with me just a moment and read this worst of all days in the life of Job, the misery of a righteous man. In verse 13, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Job loses everything he owned, and I'll tell you, if that was the end of the story, Job would have been content. Because at the end of that, he loses everyone that he loves. Everything that he owns, everyone that he loves. And the text even leaves it in the appearance that God is to blame. We say, because we want to excuse God, we want to apologize for God, we say, well, Satan did it, and God kind of permitted it, right? But ask your insurance salesman what it is when a whirlwind knocks your house down. It's an act of God. And that's what the text says. Fire came down from God. Satan doesn't have power. If God wanted to say, no, you won't, it wouldn't have happened. You see, if you're an ancient person, if you're an ancient pagan, there are lots of gods in the world for you to deal with. There could be really good gods who bless me and really bad gods who punish me and do mean things. Jewish people don't have that option. Jewish people believe in one God, which means that when something happens, you don't get to blame it on the gods you don't like. Which means you have to ask the question, what kind of God allows this sort of thing to happen in his world, and why? Why? Is it punishment? Did Job forget one day to offer the sacrifice for his 13th kid, but for the sin that he committed in his heart, and God is punishing him for it? There was something else he did wrong? He didn't file his taxes correctly and missed something on that? What is it that could possibly cause this to happen? Why does God do this? And nowhere in the text does it ever attempt to really excuse God. Nor does God excuse himself. At the end of the story, now remember, how do the children die? A whirlwind comes and destroys the house they are in and kills him. At the end of the story, God appears to Job in the form of a whirlwind. Folks, that's not the way you distance yourself from these events. God takes the specific form of the thing that bothered Job the most and says, now we'll have our conversation. The text will not let God off the hook. And neither will God. Keep reading for just a moment, because that weird scene in chapter 1, we get part 2. And chapter 2, beginning in verses 1 through 6. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? And Satan answered the Lord, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job?
that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil, he still holds fast his integrity. Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. By the way, is God saying this is all your fault? You see, if God says this is all your fault, then that means God isn't God. God is the master of the universe. He doesn't get to be anybody's victim. He never gets to say, it's somebody else that made me do it. Now, you're a human. You could say, the devil made me do it. You can try that out in a court of law. It works sometimes. But God can't say, the devil made me do it. He says, you picked this fight, but ultimately, it was God's decision. And he acknowledges it. You incited me, but I have done this thing without reason. This wasn't an act of justice. This wasn't an act of punishment. This isn't Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, you have provoked me to do this thing to make this point. Have you noticed that still he is faithful? And their running argument continues. Because Satan, it turns out, is not convinced. It turns out it takes a lot to convince Satan. It turns out if you dogmatically hold to a point of view, there's no amount of evidence that can change your mind. And Satan is a fine example of that.
Satan says, maybe not. Skin for skin. That's verse 4. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face.
This is a great example of a position. In science, they would call this a non-falsifiable position, meaning that there's nothing that God can do to provide evidence to convince Satan because he just keeps moving the goalpost. First, he says, well, take away what he has. He'll curse you. God does it. And then Satan says, well, yeah, because you just took away his stuff. You didn't hurt him. He just keeps moving the goal line, right? It's always something more to make his case. Because ultimately, this isn't an argument about reason or doctrine. This is about the crookedness in Satan's own heart. But that would be a sermon for another day. What ultimately happens is God says, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life.
I am so deeply bothered by that passage. I expect cruelty from Satan. I really do. But when I see God permitting, again, there I am making my excuse, permitting more suffering to fall on someone he himself has identified as a righteous, God-fearing man whom God says, I have no reason to do him any harm. I throw up my hands and I say, I don't know about this. And if you feel like that, you're in good company because Job's going to throw up his hands for 38 more chapters saying, I'm not sure I understand what just happened. Chapters 1 and 2 are a short, straightforward story that it takes one of the Bible's longest book to explain. What we do know is that God does allow this to continue, and so Satan takes it all a step further. Let me just back up just a moment. If you keep reading there, verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in his ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. And he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. We skipped the earlier response, but it's essentially the same sentiment. In chapter 1, verses 20 and 22, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. Read that again. Job chapter 1, verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Satan has expected that Job's trust in God ultimately isn't trust at all, that it's really self-serving. Job got a bribe. Job was given everything he wanted in life, and as long as he gets it, he'll bless the Lord. Job demonstrates that God's trust in him has been well-founded. Job shows us what actual goodness looks like, what actual faith looks like. We have an expression in our culture, trust but verified. Faith is a different kind of critter, folks. Hebrews tells us that faith is a confidence in things unseen. It was easy for Job to believe that God was good when everything that happened to Job was good. But what about on this day? When everything bad that could possibly happen fell on him from the sky on the same day. Job's response is worship. How does that even make sense? In Job's mind, apparently, he recognizes that God is so great that somehow even this mess makes sense to God. Somehow even this is something that could be explained if only he knew what God was up to. And so he simply worships God. He says, the Lord gave, the Lord took away. He said what I said a moment ago. It was never mine to start with. I never owned anything. God gave it to me, the God took it back. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And demonstrates actual trust, faith in things not seen. What do we learn from these first two chapters of Job? A lot of questions, not a lot of answers. Let me try to answer a couple of questions that we do get. Number one, is it possible for a righteous man to suffer? There is a version of the gospel out there, commonly called the prosperity gospel, but call it what you want, that essentially says if you are faithful to God, God is going to bless you with wealth and health and prosperity, and you will have everything you want the rest of your life. You write the check, God cashes it. You affirm it, and God puts it in the bank. That version of the gospel has never read the book of Job, folks. Because Job is the final statement on that question. Is it possible for a righteous man to suffer? Is Job a righteous man? Folks, if you're not sure, go back and read the first two chapters again. He is. He's a better man than I am. Does he suffer? Folks, if that's not suffering, I don't know what it is. Is it possible for a righteous man to suffer? Yes, it is. And if you get nothing else out of the book of Job, take that home with you. The promise of a relationship with God is not a promise that you will have everything you want and that everything will go the way you want. In fact, let me go a step further. This will be borderline mean, but I'm allowed sometimes. That version of the gospel is Satan's version of the gospel. The only character in the story that says you believe God and you get everything you want is Satan. And the whole point of the story is that he's wrong. That when you believe God, you don't necessarily get everything that you want. God says you haven't noticed, but that's not the way it works. And he takes everything away twice. And still we come back and say, well, I think if I were really faithful, God would give me what I wanted. Folks, that's Satan's version of it. I don't say that to be unkind, but that's the version of it you're telling. You've missed the boat of this particular story. Number two, is it possible to trust God when all of your experience points away from him? When everything that is happening in your life is difficult, I even feel dirty saying difficult. That's not even the right word. When everything in your life is just bad, when suffering is not even an adequate term to describe your experience, is it possible to trust God? I'm not even asking if you have to. I'm not asking if you should. I'm asking, is it possible? Job shows us that it's possible. That there is nothing that can happen in a human life which will force you to separate yourself from God. That ultimately, even on the worst of days, you have a choice to trust in that same God. Comprehend him? Possibly not. Like him? I'm not sure. We're going to read the next 30 chapters. There are times when Job is not sure he likes God anymore. He believes in God. He prays to God. He worships God. He's not sure what he thinks about him. On one occasion, Job will go so far as to say, I wish I had never been born. He struggles mightily. But at no point in the story does he say, I wonder if I can get a better deal from Baal. At no point in the story does he go God shopping. At no point in the story does he doubt that this is the reality, the God of the universe. And folks, it is possible
to trust in God when all of your experience points away from Him. When everything that happened causes you to doubt, God has made it possible for you to continue to trust in Him. I think we have a difficult dilemma sometimes that we think trusting God means always understanding. And that's just not the same thing. I think we mean that trust in God means always liking what God does. I hope someday I mature as a Christian to the point where I can honestly say I like everything God does in the world. That I understand Him and His character so much that when He does it, I love it. But I'm not that good a person yet. And there are still days when I look around the world and I'm saying, I don't know if I like that. I don't like that people have to suffer. I don't understand it. Maybe one day I'll grow into it. Job has to grow. Today, he says it is enough that I trust that God, that I worship that God. And that part never goes away. What about our other questions? Is it possible to understand this God when you go through your day of Job? Is it possible to like this God? I think the Bible does give an answer to that question, but it takes a longer story than I've got today. Let me just give you a taste of it, and then we'll conclude this lesson. God recognizes that there's more to that story we want to hear. And in the fullest way possible, He has come to give us the answer to that story. In Hebrews chapter 2, it describes a man of whom it says, "But we see him, who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering." The New Testament has its own version of Job. Only this person is not someone on whom terrible events fall. It is God Himself taking on flesh for the very purpose of suffering. Not to evade it, not to show us how to get around it. I think that's what some people think, that the gospel is God showing you how to get out of suffering. No, the gospel is showing you how to suffer. How to live the human life the best way possible. And the way He did that was to become just like us, to be us, and to suffer what would be our worst day. And show us the virtue and value of the life God has created for us. I think it would be difficult to like God if God said, "You folks down there suffer, it's good for you. Well, I'm going to stay up here, don't worry." Don't your kids like that? Kids go, parents say, "Go outside and work." "Well, I'm going to stay in here in the air conditioning, but you go outside and work." They have the right to do it, but you don't like them when they do it. God had the right to tell us endure suffering. But God goes a step further. The impassible and unmoving God took on flesh and suffered so that He could know that we knew that He understood and would walk by us in every cataclysm of life and every chapter and every scene. Our Job is there. I don't have the answers to every question, but I know there is no question I'll ever ask that Jesus didn't ask Himself, and to whom Jesus is not also the answer. So I would encourage you today not to turn to God because I've answered every question of life's riddle, or that I've made mysteriously and magically all your suffering go away, or even that I can promise you today that if you come forward as we stand and sing, everything will be better tomorrow. I can't make any of those promises. Job would slap me in the face if I did, because it wouldn't be true. What I instead tell you is that there was once a man in the world named Job. He was a righteous man, and he trusted God, even when no part of his life made sense. He is an example to us all, and he brings us to our own Job, Jesus Christ the righteous, who shows us how to live and how to die and how to anticipate the salvation of our God. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If you would come to him and trust, won't you do so as we stand and sing?